Okay. Well, welcome back, everyone. And my name is Ed Ward. I'm the founder of the Ward Irish Music Archives. And Cademy La Falcha, I'd like to welcome all of you here to Milwaukee, the City of Festivals. And we're honored to have you here. And I'm especially honored to be able to present presentations by two of my friends and colleagues here this afternoon, both of whom are folklorists and both of whom are archivists in their own way, and in Celtic and Irish music circles, both of whom are legends, I might add. Your first presenter will be Mick Maloney, who's a professor of Irish studies and music at NYU in New York. And when Mick isn't teaching in New York, he's globetrotting around the world pursuing his passion of Irish music. A couple months ago, he called me from Bangkok, Thailand, and that evening he was headed to Ho Chi Minh City for an Irish session in Vietnam. So you never wear, it's you know, where in the world is Matt Lauer? Where in the world in Irish music circles is Mick Maloney? He's here in Milwaukee. We're honored to have him here. Mick Maloney.
Well, I'm very honored indeed to be here, a guest of this wonderful conference. And I must say, it's quite different than my usual audience. I teach courses in Irish-American popular culture at New York University. And over the last 2 years, I conducted kind of a survey of the students at the start. I said, about 103 kids, I think, 103 or 104 over the 2 years. I said, how many of you have heard of John McCormack? And zero was the number. I said, how many of you have heard of Bing Crosby? Two. I said, how many of you have heard of the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem? Four. So we have a habit of forgetting very quickly, and what I'm going to be talking about today is a largely forgotten part of Irish musical history, and particularly Irish-American music history. It would be almost unknown to most people in Ireland. In fact, the acoustic era set of recordings of Irish music made in America from, say, the late 1880s onwards up to 1925. And to put it in kind of a historical context, around the era that the acoustic recordings were being made, the Irish were very well established in America. About a million had come in the 18th century, mostly from the northern part of the country, and many of those settled in the southern Appalachians and integrated there with English and Scottish, African-American and Cherokee and German settlers and contributed to the emergence of old-time music with a strong Irish imprint. In the 19th century, starting around 1800, a flood of immigrants started to come, or trickle, should I say, from the southern part of Ireland, about a million up to the year 1844. And then, of course, the Great Famine starts in 1845. And between the beginning of the Great Famine and the end of the century, an estimated 4.5 million Irish people came to America, mostly from rural Ireland, a lot from Gaelic-speaking rural Ireland. And the overwhelming majority of those would have settled in urban America from coast to coast, leaving a really strong imprint on American cultural life. I'm going to be talking about the music of the acoustic era, and by that stage there were several kinds of Irish music in America. There was the music, the song, the instrumental music and the song that the immigrants had brought with them from Ireland. And we've always been a stratified society in Ireland, so there would have been an upper crust, a literate, musically literate set of people who would have probably enjoyed and identified with the compositions of well-known composers of the 19th century like Samuel Lover and of course Thomas Moore. And they were very much designed for Victorian drawing room sensibilities, and sung an awful lot by Irish tenors and other kinds of tenors in America all through the Victorian era. Then there would have been the instrumental music brought from Ireland, played on instruments that are now common in Irish traditional music, the Uilleann pipes and the fiddle, and later on the concertina and the accordion. This was very much a home tradition. Made it onto the stage fitfully at times, and the Irish were present in great numbers in all the varieties of American popular culture in the 19th century, starting with minstrelsy, where it seems just about one out of every two blacked-up minstrels was either Irish or Irish-American, and then through variety theatre and through vaudeville, and then, of course, through the burgeoning entertainment, multifaceted entertainment scene in America in the early 20th century. So there's always been different kinds of Irish music. My first love, and Harry Bradshaw, who's going to follow me today are both our first love, is the older instrumental music, and I play that music myself on the tenor banjo. And in fact, I'm very honored to be able to start, with the permission of Ed Ward and the great people at Irish Fest, to start my presentation today with recordings that never have actually been played in public. They were made in Chicago by the police chief of Chicago, great Irish music collector, Captain Francis O'Neill, made in the year 1913, as far as we can figure out. These have been recently donated to the Irish Fest archive. You'll be visiting there later tonight, and being remastered, very lovingly remastered at the Library of Congress. And Ed tells me this is the first public performance or public presentation of these wonderful aspects of what I would call the home traditions brought from rural Ireland. And the two pieces I'll play for you. One is Sergeant James Early, who was a sergeant of the police force. Captain Francis O'Neill was very friendly to the idea of Irish musicians joining the police force in Chicago for obvious reasons. And he's accompanied by James McFadden. So these are very historic recordings, the first presentation of these recordings ever since they were made. That's Early and McFadden, and the other recording I'm going to play is of a great fiddle player called Edward Cronin, whose music is practically unknown today. Sorry? Oh,
Edward Cronin.
Edward Cronin, okay. Edward Cronin, a great fiddle player who was also living in Chicago at this time. And his name would be known to aficionados of the history of Irish music, but nobody has ever heard a recording of his music until right now. Edward Cronin. There's only one other piece that I'm going to play of what we call traditional Irish instrumental music, and it's because I have a personal connection with this recording in a way that was memorable in my own life. And I met the banjo player who was the first of the great banjo players. Harry, how do I open this thing here? Do you know? I hit it a bit harder. This is a man on the banjo called Mike Flanagan, and I arrived in America in 1973 and had heard of the Flanagan brothers, and they were all I knew about them is that they were a wonderful duo that recorded in what Harry is going to be talking about, the golden age of Irish recordings of this kind, traditional Irish music, back in the 20s. And I was enormously fortunate to meet him. He was still alive in his 80s in Albany, New York, 1977. And here's a 1921 recording on the New Republic label of Mike Flanagan and Joe Flanagan. Thank you. Mike and Joe Flanagan there in 1921 for the New Republic label, and Harry Bradshaw. In fact, this is taken from a CD of Flanagan Brothers reissues by Harry Bradshaw, and I'm indebted to Harry for making this recording available to me. That's the last of the traditional music that I'm going to be playing, because really what I wanted to concentrate on was popular Irish-American material, and for reasons that are actually gone into in a historic letter that Harry's going to read you in his presentation, not too much of this music was recorded in the acoustic era, and not just because, say, instruments like the fiddle were very hard to record. It was a kind of a sense that it was very marginal in the Irish-American tradition. Part of it was because the Irish had been around in America so long, I suppose there was a tendency not to consider them an ethnic group in the same way as more newly arrived immigrants speaking other languages. That might be part of it. Also because a lot of expectations about what Irish music was supposed to sound like had been forged on the American stage, particularly the character of the stage Irishman, which proliferated all the way through the 19th century, the kind of pugnacious, brawling, dim-witted Irishman who graced many a production in England indeed before he came to America. It was kind of a stock figure. And when, especially in vaudeville, people were performing Irish material, there was a tendency to kind of to drift into that mode of representing the Irish as a semi-imbecilic type figure. And even when the position of the Irish in American society became a little more secure as the years went on after the famine, the Irish were still marginalised and a very, very set of stock images accompanying them, comic images for the most part. And even as they became benign, they were still semi-infantilized. So American, it's no surprise really that the first examples of American popular culture should be connected to vaudevillian type skits where the Irish, in a kind of a patented patois, a brogue that seems to be developed on the English and later on the American stage, would do sketches. These two examples are very hard to listen to, but they're some of the earliest examples in the 1890s of the kind of Irish skit or the Irish sketch which was so popular in vaudeville. This is an early recording which was made in the early 1890s, is all it says here. It's by a woman called Mrs. McCormack, and it's called The Irishman's Perplexity. Extremely hard to listen to. I'll just put on for a few seconds.
Following piece, right by Mrs. McCormack, entitled The Irishman's Perplexity.
Have mercy enough on a little thing to church, and after returning to land, this woman and friend asked what luck we had.
Oh, we had a most elegant going, once in a time.
Who were of your party? Asked the friend.
There was Fuego.
There was himself, that's one.
The good Robinson, that's two. Jim Jason, that's three.
Well, it's almost impossible to listen, but just to give you an example of the genre that was so popular in vaudeville. And the person who was most famous for doing this kind of sketch was Russell Hunting, who had a whole series of Casey recordings. And here's one of them. This is on the Archaeophone Before Radio CD. And I'm indebted to the wonderful Hennessy's for this recording. And it's made in 1897.
By Russell Hunting. Oh, my, daddy, will you close your face and go to sleep?
Casey putting the baby to sleep.
Your mama ain't your papa good enough for you. I'll have to sing him a little mite of a song, I think. Mary had a little goat, his skin was bright and blue. And every place that Mary went, Billy thought he would go to. Yeah. Oh, my, can't you do this? If you can't be easy, you can't anyhow. Humpty Dumpty, what a one. Humpty Dumpty, how did you fun?
I often wondered who bought these and why. I mean, they were produced, so presumably there would have been some sale in mind. I became very interested in the kind of material that was not recorded at all in the acoustic era. I've become a great fan of the most prolific Irish songwriting duo of the whole 19th century. They wrote in all over 220 songs together, and it seems that almost half of them were connected to very real Irish-American themes, and they were very much involved in the theatre of realism in New York City. I'm speaking of Harrigan and Braham, and along with this, the Flanagan Brothers, along with their cohort Tony Hart, They produced scores of plays and lots of wonderful songs. I put out a whole CD recently of their songs, and it would have lines, for instance, like, "That great conglomeration of men from every nation, the Tower of Babylonium, it couldn't equal that. A great institution where the brogues without dilution, they rattled on together in McNally's row of flats. And it's Ireland and Italy, Jerusalem and Germany, Chinese and Africans, and a paradise for rats all jumbled up together in the snow and rainy weather. They constitute the tenants in McNally's row of flats." And this is mighty stuff by any standards. And Edward Harrigan was known as the Charles Dickens of New York. He liked that a lot himself. And he wrote songs that really reflected a kind of a social reality that was really new to American theatre. People like John Brogham and Dion Boucicault and Augustine Daly had kind of flirted in a generic way with it. But Harrigan and his cohort Brame, they wrote songs that really reflected an Irish-American reality in a way that never had happened before. And it was really an Irish-American rather than an Irish reality, with the Irish adjusting to new life in America, working in the occupations like the railroad and canal building, coal mining, urban construction, the Irish involved in city politics, tenement life, and interaction with other ethnic groups, and an extraordinary body of songs, and yet almost completely unrepresented in the acoustic era. And I wondered why, and I suppose it's because in the acoustic era, the younger performers would have considered those the songs of their fathers. And in the history of recording, people have been more likely to look to modern songs as their own personal statement rather than something inherited from their parents. Harrigan and Hart, their era was to beginning really, as Tony Hart died tragically very young in the 1880s, and Ed Harrigan's heyday was really over by the time that the acoustic era started in earnest in the 1890s. So in a sense, he was kind of a man, unfortunately, before his time, which is why his name is almost completely forgotten today. In fact, it's only really known through one man, and that's through George M. Cohan, who wrote a song for a play called 50 Miles from Boston, recorded by one of the great figures in the acoustic era, Billy Murray. And if it weren't for this song, nobody would know the name of Harrigan at all today. And even if they know the song, they probably don't even know who the name refers to. This is Billy Murray with a song I'm sure a lot of you know. It's a 1907 recording. It's David Braham.
Who is the man who will spend or will even lend?
Harrigan!
That's me. Who is your friend when you find that you need a friend?
Harrigan!
That's me. For I'm just as proud of my name, you see, as an emperor, czar, or a king could be. Who is the man, helps a man every time he can?
Harrigan!
That's me. H-A-R-R-I-G-A-N, spelled Harrigan. Proud of all the Irish blood that's in me. Devil a man can say a word again me. H-A-R-R-I-G-A-N, you see, is a name that a shame never has been connected with.
Harrigan!
That's me. Who is the man never stood for a gadabout?
Harrigan!
That's me. Who is the man that the town's simply mad about?
Harrigan!
That's me. The ladies and babies are fond of me. I'm fond of them too in return, you see. Who is the gent that's deserving a monument?
Harrigan!
That's me.
George M. Cohan, of course, he starts out his musical career with the Cohan family, great vaudevillians. And the Cohans were Cohans originally. They came from Ireland. A lot of people think they were Jewish, but in fact, they were Irish-American. And another character who was very popular at the time, George Gascon, I was going to play some of his stuff, but I'll run through it. This is Billy Murray, who was singing that song, Harrigan. Billy Murray, really an extraordinary character, born in Philadelphia. And Billy Murray was known as the Denver Nightingale, His parents came from County Kerry, moved the family to Denver, and he found he had a talent in acting and flirted briefly with minstrelsy, and then moved back and became one of the most prolific singers in the whole recording era, the acoustic recording era. And if I can find his CD here now. Well, it's the dreaded disappearing CD thing. Anyway, you'd have to take my word for it. Billy Murray, one of the great singers of the acoustic era, and specializing in a lot of Irish material, of course, an awful lot of American material as well. And he had a long and very distinguished life. Died at the age of 77 in Jones's Beach in New York in the year 1954, and a completely forgotten figure today. And he sang one of his most favourite songs, "If It Wasn't for the Irish and the Jews." The Irish and the Germans got together. It takes the Irish to beat the Dutch, indulging in a lot of inter-ethnic humour, which is very common in the acoustic recordings of the time. Henry Burr, another very famous figure. In the recording, in the acoustic recording era, who was originally Harry McClintock from New Brunswick, and he was one of the great tenors of the time, and recorded prodigiously. And this is one of his Irish recordings called "Peg of My Heart."
Heart in a whirl over one little girl. I love her, yes I do. Although her heart is far away, I hope to make her mine someday. Every beautiful rose, every violet note, I love her fond and true. And her heart fondly sighs as I sing to her eyes, her eyes of blue, sweet eyes of blue, my darling. Take of my heart, I love you.
Henry Burr. And the Peerless Quartet, an awful lot of Irish recordings made by the various quartets, the American Quartet and the Peerless Quartet would have been two of the most prominent quartets, and Henry Burr is in this one. It's an Irish war song, First World War song called "Fog of Balla."
There's a new world used today in the trenches, so they say. It makes them fight with all their might, and it means to clear the way. It's Irish as can be, and it scares the enemy. For when they hear this battle cheer, it's goodbye Germany.
Fog of Balla,
the Dublin boys are here.
Fog of Balla,
just listen to them cheer.
We'll carry on till that one is gone, and even then we'll come again. Just help the boys along by singing Fog of Balla.
There's something troubling Dublin, and
we God will know just who. For we'll march right through like the Irish always do when we sing Fog of Balla in the morning.
Ada Jones, getting to women in the Irish acoustic era. Ada Jones, a remarkable woman with a huge, prolific set of recordings, an awful lot of them on the Irish or Irish-American theme. And she originally came from England. She was born in Manchester, moved to the New Jersey area at a very early age. And according to the story, which may be apocryphal, was discovered by Billy Murray singing in the Huber's Dime Museum on 14th Street in Western Greenwich Village. And she teamed up a lot with Billy Murray, also with Len Spencer, and did a tremendous number of Irish American songs. This is My Irish Rosie, which featured a lot in the sheet music of the day as well.
My Irish Rosie, sung by Ada Jones, Edison Records.
Bright moonlight, come out, Rosie, for tonight's the night. My sweet Arun, come out and spoon. Night birds cooing in the trees above, wait to greet you with their songs of love. My Rosie, oh, I love you so. Oh, Rosie, dear, and did you hear the news that's going round? Rosie, my Rosie, my Irish Rosie, come out, love and spoon. Maytime is playtime, come have a gay time under the young May moon. My love is true, dear, I love but you, dear, nobody else will do. Every star up in the sky so bright seems to tell me that your heart's all right. My charming Irish Rosie, Rosie, my Rosie, my Irish.
Well, definitely the most colourful woman singing Irish songs, Irish-American songs in the acoustic era was Nora Bayes. Now, one of the theories that Nora Bayes was born Nora Goldberg in Milwaukee. So this could be a very local story here. Or Joliet, Illinois. Her past very much shrouded in mystery before she arrives in New York in the 1890s and performs with Ziegfeld Follies and turns into a singing sensation when she teams up and eventually marries Jack Norwood, who, of course, wrote the song Take Me Out of the Ball Game. One of her biggest hits was Has Anybody Here Seen Kelly? I'll spin it forward here, which was recorded in 1910. This is part of the kind of stock repertoire of Irish Americana to this day.
Sweetheart from the county Cork, were bent upon a holiday. They landed in New York. They strolled around to see the sight. Alas, it's sad to say, poor Kelly lost his little girl up on the great white way. She walked uptown from Herald Square, the 42nd Street. The traffic stopped when she died too, the coffer on the bed. Has anybody here seen Kelly? K-E-W-N-Y. Has anybody here seen Kelly? Oh, you'd know him by his smile. His hair is red and his eyes are blue. He is Irish through and through. Has anybody here seen Kelly? Kelly from the Emerald Isle.
Nora Bayes, a very colourful and very tempestuous character, also very jealous of the good looks and great success of her husband, Jack Norworth, and insisted on being billed as Nora Bayes, assisted and admired by Jack Norworth. Shortly thereafter, he exited stage left. I think he was the second of what turned out to be five husbands of Nora, who died like a lot of the charismatic entertainers of that time, virtually penniless in New York City. And I don't know, this is a challenge to find that anybody could record a song called The Ancient Order of Hibernians. But she obviously was commissioned by them, I would imagine. The AOHs of the USA. That's certainly the oddest title of any Irish American song I've come across.
Thank you.
disease. Like the K of C's or the K of C's, or any club that needs to meet the A's and C's. Cause if you don't, here's why I ask you. I know the one you should belong. Sure, they're always with you when you're right. They're even with you when you're wrong. The A-O-H's of the USA, they're the finest bunch of men today. Say, by the way, who holds your high positions? Who are your politicians? Diplomatic, democratic, first in peace and first in war. They don't care what they're fighting for. And they're wonderful when on parade, when they're marching up the avenue. Roo! You never in your life meet a finer clan than the aged and the honorable Hibernian. The A-O-H's of the USA.
Well, Nora Bayes catapulted herself to national stardom with the song George M. Cohan's Over There in the Middle of the First World War, when America was awash with patriotism. And this is a tremendous recording, and can't leave Nora Bayes without a brief rendition of Over There, Cohan's masterpieces.
Get your gun, take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, everyone for liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, start today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud our boys in line. Over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drum, drum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back.
Over there. Chauncey Alcott, a hugely successful figure on the stage, was a great inspiration to the next man I'm going to talk about, John McCormack. But Chauncey Alcott himself, a songwriter, singer, ex-minstrel in his own right, one of the great colourful figures of late 19th century and early 20th century Irish Americana. And one of his most famous songs, he wrote several Irish-American chestnuts, My Wild Irish Rose, of course. Mother McCree would be another one of his big hits. And his most enduring hit is like the anthem of Irish America every March. It's When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. Here's his version of that, and then I'll follow it up immediately with the person who really made the song into the household name that it is today. This is Alcott's When Irish Eyes Are Smiling.
There is a tear in your eye, and I'm wondering why, for it never should be there at all. Some of the power of your smile could have stolen your big eye, and there is never a tear drop should fall. With your sweet lilting laughter like some fairy song, and your eyes sparkling bright as can be, you should laugh all the while, and all other times smile, and now smile a while.
Okay, and now here we're going to switch to the man who was really the icon of Irish America in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, John McCormack, born in Athlone, the County Westmeath, and his first appearance after winning one of the most prestigious vocal competitions in Ireland, the Fesh Ciol in Dublin in the year 2000, or the year 1903, was to represent Ireland at the World's Fair in St. Louis. And he did so with great alacrity, not knowing that World's Fairs are the things that they are, the entities that they are. I worked in one World's Fair in Knoxville in 1982. They're 6 months long, all of them, and the performing conditions are absolutely impossible. You're performing to audiences trying to, as Henry Glassy, the great folklorist in Bloomington says, trying to entrap fugitive attention. Well, very, very difficult. And it wasn't at all what he thought it would be. And eventually he engineers a departure, breaking his contract, on the grounds of health, but also because he objected to the stage Irish skits that were being performed there by one Patrick Toohey, a great piper. But here's McCormack's magnificent 1917 recording, when he did finally come back to America after undergoing training in Italy and becoming a fantastic star in opera. And also as a solo concert artist in Europe and in America. He comes back and he records, I think, this extraordinary version of When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, Alcott's masterpiece.
There's a tear in your eye, and I'm wondering why, for it never should be there at all. With such power in your smile, sure I've shown you beguile, so there's never a teardrop should fall. When your sweet lilting laughter is like some fairy song, and your eyes twinkle bright as can be, you should laugh all the while, and all other times smile, and now smile a smile for me. When Irish eyes are smiling,
his greatest voice,
like a morning spring, in the lilt of Irish laughter, you can hear the angels sing. When Irish hearts are happy, all the world seems bright and gay. And when Irish eyes are smiling, sure they steal your heart away.
McCormack singing one of the great anthems of Irish America. And you know, growing up in Ireland, we didn't understand this at all. We didn't understand this is an invented reality. If the stage Irishman and the image of the Irish in the American stage was a very restricted set of images, at least rooted in some kind of reality. I mean, there are Irish pubs all over the world. You don't find too many Chinese pubs, you know. There's always some semblance of reality to every stereotype, but what makes it a stereotype is that it's particular aspects of behavior are overemphasized. But here was Sin Pan Alley, with the whole invented set of attributes to Ireland. And I never really understood this. We thought the Yanks were daft, coming off the plane at Shannon Airport and looking for this kind of invented Ireland. And of course, we in Ireland were very willing to supply them with that reality at the right price, inventing medieval banquets creating a kind of an Irish-American theme park in Killarney. And we were always willing to make a few dollars doing that, and nothing wrong with that. But it wasn't until I came to America and did a tour of America in 1995, the 150th anniversary of the Irish famine. I was given the story of the Irish famine. A lot of Irish artists, historians, and writers and singers were on the go at that time. And I was in places like Moli, Linaloy, and Peoria, and Des Moines, and out in Spokane, mostly performing to Irish societies, a lot of Ancient Order of Hibernians chapters. And people who come up to me at the end of it in their 80s and say to me, now we know why our grandparents never talked about Ireland. Never told us anything about Ireland. And I suppose you have to set this whole understanding in the context of a traumatized refugee population that cannot afford to relive the past every single day. What are you going to tell your children? Are you going to tell them about the reality of hoarding food from your neighbors while they died? Are you going to tell them about the survival guilt that perhaps you feel because you survived and other people didn't? Of course you're not. And here along comes Tin Pan Alley. I often wonder why sensible people bought into it. Well, at least it was positive, and that's why they did it. And it wasn't until I did that in 1995 that the pen penny, the light came on, and I understood why people bought into the image willingly, because it was positive. And McCormack, of course, he made his reputation partly as an operatic singer, but as time went on in America, more and more as a singer of a combined classical repertoire with limited accompaniment, and Irish-American songs written by people like Chauncey Alcott. And he performed to huge audiences. This is a McCormack audience. I mean, everywhere, full houses everywhere for years. And it wasn't until I came here and talked to people who'd been at his concerts, and talked to people like my second cousin, May Mullins, up in Dedham, who had a whole stock of Red Seal records, that I understood how iconic and important a figure he was for a population that had undergone a lot of discrimination and negative publicity in America. And in a sense, McCormack completed the circle in a way that the next person to complete it was Bing Crosby, and really set the seal on was John F. Kennedy's presidency. It was a kind of a prideful audience that he played for, and of course he was a magnificent artist in his own right as well. And then he sang American songs. He became an American citizen in 1919, and by then he'd recorded the George M. Cohan classic in the middle of the First World War. And this is a song that is hardly ever heard, when you come back, and you will come back. I'll play a verse of it. Performing more stirring renditions of, I suppose, the songs that were American, prideful of his American, new American citizenship. And I suppose the ultimate accolade he gets is when Nora Bayes records a song in his honour. And it's when John McCormack sings a song, and she does her best to sound like John McCormack. And you can be the judge of how successful she is. I'll try to pretend it's John McCormack here.
Camille, I want to ask you something. This is strictly between ourselves. Did you ever hear a robin singing in the month of May, or a dove a coon in a cherry tree? No, there's music in each measure of each little woodland treasure. Sure, there's just one songbird in this world.
John McCormack and his extraordinary success. McCormack and Crosby, of course, Crosby's story belongs to the electronic era, and his meteoric rise to fame in the 1930s, coupled with all the great films he made in the 1940s, more and more with Irish songs like Tura Lura Lura, When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, break into an Irish song anytime he could. And one of my favourite scenes is actually in the film The Top of the Morning, where the Blarney Stone gets stolen. And it's insured by an insurance firm in New York. Everything is able to be insured, even the Blarney Stone. And Crosby goes to Ireland as the insurance agent to investigate the theft. But before he goes, they have to invent an excuse for him when he's signing his immigration papers to sing When Irish Eyes Are Smiling to a young child. And McCormack and Crosby, between them, they create the kind of very restricted Irish-American repertoire that's known today and sung today in the month of March, particularly in America, along with all the fight songs, you know, the songs of Irish belligerence and the drinking and the slugging and so on. It's a very restricted and very benign set of images, but gone is a kind of, I suppose, the diversity of the acoustic ear, the playful rivalry between the Irish and the Jews, the Irish and the Germans, the Irish and the Italians and so on, that was so prominent also in the year of Harrigan and Hart. You gain something, you lose something. And McCormack, well, he lost a lot towards the end. He lived life very passionately, and he had a classic addictive personality, looked a lot different towards the end than he did at the start, and one of the great iconic figures in Irish American culture. I'd like to finish, however, with, in a sense, to bookend this very short excursion through a very complex and long era, back with the traditional music, the home traditions, which now were to achieve a different kind of flowering in the 1920s, the golden age of Irish music. I'm going to hand over to Harry Bradshaw to talk about that. But one of the meetings I had, my own fateful meetings that led me into this whole era of recording, was in Boston in 1977. I was visiting my second cousin, Mae Mullins, who's still alive. She's in her late 80s. She worked in the courthouse in Dedham for years and had great store of old records. Hers were the first 78 records I had of the Irish-American experience. And she introduced me to a man. She said, there's a man I'd like you to meet. And he was in his late 80s, a man called Justice O'Byrne DeWitt. And I went and interviewed him and heard the fascinating story of how he started the whole Irish recording industry in the acoustic era of the home traditions, the traditional music, the beautiful traditional music that is now flowering in the across the world as never before, the kind of a hidden jewel in a country that really hadn't been touched by the major imprints that hit other countries in Europe. The Roman Empire, the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution never really hit Ireland to any great extent. So in a kind of a backwater, economic, political, cultural backwater, this wonderful folk or traditional music that is now flowering was enabled to evolve in a very leisurely way. But it only started to be part of the, in any concerted way, of the American recording tradition when Justice O'Byrne DeWitt, at the behest of his mother, Ellen O'Byrne DeWitt, went out to find Irish musicians to record for Columbia, because there were no Irish recordings at the time that the immigrants were, of the kind the immigrants were clamouring for. The Irish immigrants coming wanted to hear the kind of music that's left behind at home. So he found two musicians called John Wheeler and Eddie Herburn, banjo and accordion, good for recording in the acoustic era because they made a lot of noise. And they went and they recorded for Columbia in 1917, and the next chapter of Irish music in the acoustic and later the electronic era was the start in what became known as the golden age of Irish music. I'd like to finish with Herburn and Wheeler, this fateful first recording of Irish traditional music in the acoustic era.
Yep, hit play very hard. Hit it really hard. We can't. This is a fateful moment. This has to be consummated properly now. I'd like to thank my colleague here for all his help, and thank. Here we go. This is a tune called The Mouse in the Cupboard.
thank you very much. I'd like to hand over now to Harry Bradshaw.
Thank you, Mick. I think you can see, if you've read the program, why Mick, with his knowledge of Irish music and early American Irish music, why he was awarded a few years ago by the National Endowment of the Arts and Humanities with their National Heritage Award. But he's a real treasure in the Irish music world.